from KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Two tragic drownings were in the news this week, one involving a four-year-old at Great America Amusement Park, and the other involving a developmentally disabled child whose drowning 5 years ago was the subject of a state Supreme Court ruling on Monday. The two incidents have focused new concern on recreational safety and the rights and responsibilities of both recreational programs and parents. Should recreational sites be more tightly regulated? What rights do parents have to sue when something goes tragically wrong? Or do parents simply need to pay more attention? We'll take up those topics next on Forum after this. From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. A week ago Thursday, 4-year-old Carlos Alejandro Flores drowned in the wave pool at Great America Amusement Park in Santa Clara. A state senator has already proposed new legislation requiring life vests for small children before entering those kinds of pools. On Monday, the state Supreme Court ruled that the parents of a developmentally disabled child could sue the city of Santa Barbara, even though they'd signed a liability waiver after their daughter died while taking part in a city recreation program. Both stories involve tragic loss, and both also raise different questions about the rights and responsibilities of parents and the liability of both private and public recreational activities. How will these stories impact recreational programs in the future? The Santa Barbara case has everyone from city programs to private health clubs worried about their ability to stay open if signed liability waivers are not valid. And the Great America drowning prompts questions about whether or not we need more regulation or whether or not we need more parental supervision. In a few minutes, we'll hear a variety of points of view on this question, but we thought we'd start with just a few words of advice about child safety from a pediatrician about how parents should evaluate risk and safety during these summer months. Joining us to do that first, Dr. Yan Chin. He's chief of pediatrics for San Francisco On-Call Medical Group. Dr. Chin, good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
Just a word of advice about these wave pools in particular and pools in general. How would you suggest that parents evaluate that kind of risk?
Well, I think for parents of young children, any body of water can serve as a, you know, a nidus of risk. I think the probably a couple take-home points from this, and these things always serve as a good wake-up call. It's like the earthquake we just had.
Right.
Nice wake-up call to all of us. It's tragic, but you know, we need to pay attention. I think that's probably the first take-home point. Parents need to pay attention. Inattention can lead to bad things. You know, falling asleep while sunning, while your kid's taking is in the pool or at the beach, taking a quick cell phone call that lasts for 10 minutes. You know, talking to your fellow parents about the new Harry Potter movie, all while you probably should be paying closer attention to your child. I think the second take-home point is probably proximity. Doesn't matter how good your intentions are, you can't help them if you're not near them. The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that for children under 4 years of age, parents should probably be within one arm's length whenever they're in the water. And then probably the third take-home point is just back off from undue risk. And this applies to probably not just pools, but, you know, any summertime activity. We have a couple more sunny months here in the Bay Area. And, you know, parents are doing all sorts of things, you know, going, you know, taking all-terrain vehicles with their kids or, you know, wakeboarding in the ocean, and kids are skateboarding. I think, you know, anytime you're supervising, I'd say just back off one step from what you might do as an adult. You know, do you really need to go down that really steep hill? You know, do you really need to be listening to your iPod full blast while skateboarding in a street? You know, I think, you know, we live in a pretty complex society these days with lots of potential risk, and we just have to be wise, and we have to teach our children to be wise about minimizing the opportunity to have our butts kicked by these kind of behaviors.
In the end, it really sounds like basic common sense should apply, which is to sort of back off a bit and pay attention.
That's right. That's right.
Dr. Yan Chin joining us this morning from his office at the 24-hour on-call medical group in San Francisco, chief of pediatrics there. Dr. Yan Chin, thanks for providing that advice this morning to get us started.
Thanks, Dave.
And joining us now, State Senator Elaine Ahlquist. She represents the San Jose area, and she has proposed legislation in wake of the tragic drowning at Great America, which, among other things, would require life vests for those children who are less than 4 feet tall. It would set a ratio for lifeguards in relationship to the number of swimmers present, and it would also prohibit children who are under a certain size from going into those sorts of pools unless accompanied by a parent. Senator Ahlquist, thanks for joining us. Can you tell us first your thinking about why this is a matter that needs regulation?
Well, first, thank you for having me on the program, Dave. And the reason I think that this needs regulation is that as a senator, as a parent, as a yaya, which is a Greek word for grandmother, I have two grandchildren, we want our children to be safe. And we expect that when we go to a water park, to a wave pool, that they will be. I think parents have a false sense of safety, a false sense of security at the water parks. And so when I after this tragedy at Great America, I with Carlos, I researched the law. And first of all, it was hard to find anything on the regulation of water parks and wave pools. And second, what I could find basically said, be safe. And, you know, what does that mean, just be safe? I mean, there was no specific policy, nothing consistent that needed to be done regulated statewide. And so that is why I'm working on this.
Do you think in the end this is something that where the balance needs to be more, though, on the side of parental attention in the way that we heard Dr. Chin just describe? Because in a sense, can any regulation really overcome that sort of fundamental need for parental supervision?
Well, first let me say that I really appreciated Dr. Yang Chin's comments. I think he really was right on target. I've always believed that parents are really, you know, ultimately responsible. They have the highest priority when it comes to children. What really happened here, though, is there was the mother of Carlos who watched him when he was in the pool, and there was just, you know, just in a blink of an eye when the wave came on, and she's outside the pool. You know, we need to visualize this. She's outside the pool watching him, and for, you know, just a short length of time, she can't see him. The wave comes on, and then he dies.
Right, right.
So, I mean, and I'm not laying blame anywhere. I'm just saying that I'd like to put some specific policies into place. I'm writing the bill now that would, number one, at a minimum, require water parks and amusement parks to provide life vests for non-swimmers and children 4 feet high and under. Number two, to look at an age or height limitation for kids to be in these pools unattended. Number three, to look at the ratio of lifeguards to children in the pools. And number four, to have a warning signal when the wave is about to begin.
Yeah. Senator Ahlquist, thank you. I know you've been called into session and have to leave us, but we'll follow with interest the progress of your legislation.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for being with us.
Bye-bye.
We're going to take up now the bigger questions that both of these sad stories bring up about the role of parents, but also the role of regulation and about the liability consequences and what this might mean for everyone from a public recreational program to a private amusement park like Great America. Joining us now to take up those topics, Steve Sugarman. He's Agnes Roddy Robb Professor of Law at the Bolt Hall School of Law at the University of California, Berkeley. Professor Sugarman, good morning.
Good morning.
Joining us as well, Steve Wiley. He is city attorney for the city of Santa Barbara. That's the city that sponsored the summer recreation program that was involved in the case that was ruled on this week by the state Supreme Court. Steve Wiley, good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
And here, too, is Catherine Mangue Ward. She's associate editor of Reason magazine and writes frequently on topics similar to this. Catherine Mangue Ward, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's begin, and let's start with this recent state Supreme Court ruling first. We'll come back to the Great America incident. But again, the state Supreme Court ruling ruled this week that the parents of a developmentally disabled 14-year-old who was drowned at a city summer camp program sponsored by the city of Santa Barbara, that those parents, even though they signed a waiver in advance, could go could go to trial. And this child, by way of background, was someone who suffered from periodic seizures, had one in the locker room before going in the pool. But the camp counselor who was assigned to her decided in the end to let her go into the pool. And although he was watching her when the counselor turned away briefly, the girl indeed drowned. Again, they had signed a waiver, the parents had, but the courts have now ruled that that case can go to trial. So let's talk some about the implications of that and what's at stake. Steve Wiley, from the city of Santa Barbara's standpoint, you were joined also, interestingly, by a wide variety of recreational organizations, everyone from the Sierra Club to go-kart racetracks and so forth. So give us your sense, not so much on the pros and cons of the case, but what the implications are, why this matters so much for cities, but also for private recreational operators as well.
Well, I think it matters particularly for cities and recreation districts and nonprofits. You know, there are a tremendous number of small nonprofits out there that offer recreation, summer camps, for example. We've got many in Santa Barbara, from the zoo through agencies that offer horseback riding. And they try to, in particular, offer it for developmentally disabled kids. And I think the long-term impact of this decision may be that they are going to really think twice about some of the more potentially dangerous activities that they offer. In our case, this was what we called adventure camp. And only part of it, only a few hours of a week-long camp experience was in the public pool. So, for example, I think we need to, as a city, look very long and hard about how we offer recreation opportunities to developmentally disabled children, and whether that will involve the pool, whether that will involve horseback riding, which was another element of this camp, or in our case, we have a lot of camps that involve ocean swimming, not necessarily for developmentally disabled children, but for children generally.
And is that for reasons of both fear of lawsuit, but also insurance costs? Do both things come into play?
They do. Since I've been in the municipal government business for a long time, and we recall the early 80s, 83, 84, when insurance companies were getting out of in the business of insuring liability for cities, and it was virtually impossible to get insurance at the time. It's certainly gotten better since then. But, for example, Santa Barbara's deductible, our self-insured retention right now, is $1 million per accident per person. So our insurance, we've got a high deductible. It's very expensive. And I don't think this decision is going to help. I understand what the Supreme Court was saying, is that that's not a necessarily logical conclusion, or the evidence in other states may not prove that to be the case. But I don't think the industry or even people who analyze risk always act on hard evidence. I mean, it's not hard. It's just a very subjective determination, and so I think they err on the side of not incurring the risk, and I think the risk is that with recreation programs will become very bland.
And so for you, it's the greater good sort of question. The implications are that in the end, developmentally disabled children or children, no matter their status, will perhaps not have the same kind of opportunities that they would otherwise?
That's correct. The city of Santa Barbara has a good history of offering programs for developmentally disabled children. And just the nature of Santa Barbara in our region, we are the recreation provider. The county really doesn't do that. So it's not just the 95,000 people who live in Santa Barbara. It's really more like 250,000 people who live on the south coast of Santa Barbara County.
And presumably, I suspect those are also then children who may not have other opportunities, whose families may not have the means to have opportunities, and you provide those to those sorts of children. Let's get Professor Sugarman involved in our discussion again. He's professor of law again at Bolt Hall School of Law at the University of California, Berkeley. As you look at this case, Professor Sugarman, what comes to mind to you in terms of what's at stake?
Well, this in this case, I think the unstated position of Santa Barbara and all the friends that they gather to join them is that our entire legal system is very unreliable in its operation. Because, and I think the Supreme Court, our California Supreme Court, doesn't believe that and thinks that our judges at the trial level and our juries are able to make generally speaking, reasonable, sensible decisions about who's responsible for injuries that people or deaths that people suffer. Because, remember, in this case, the parents claimed that the Santa Barbara, through its employees in this adventure, summer adventure program for disabled children, were grossly negligent. And the California Supreme Court said, well, we're not going to let public bodies or private bodies get away with being grossly negligent and by getting people to waive their rights to sue against their grossly negligent conduct. And that's the position in almost every other state, the California position now that we have announced by our court. I think what the defendants are worried about is that even though it's supposed to be only liability, at least that's what got decided here, for gross negligence, that even that standard is something that juries might disregard and say, oh, well, we're sympathetic to the plaintiff, somebody died, they've a deep pocket defendant, and that they're feared that the system will somehow, even in such a case, the jury will find there to be gross negligence when there wasn't maybe negligence at all, and that that's what they're afraid of. And this kind of defendants are, generally speaking around the state, are worried about whether our legal system is functioning fairly and holding them responsible when they should be, and this is a good opportunity for them to make that claim. Although I think that the claim that they have, that the fear is going to cause these programs to dry up, I think they offered no evidence of that, yeah, except hunches. And it may be that some will react with extreme extreme caution, especially governments. After all, they're not in the business to make a profit, although I don't think it's really very likely. We don't see this in other areas of city government operation, I think.
And, what about, sorry, go ahead.
And we don't see this in other states, as the California Supreme Court pointed out. There's no indication that in New York, if Santa Barbara were located in New York, not only wouldn't they be able to waive gross negligence, they wouldn't be able to waive even ordinary negligence. And there's no indication that New York cities are stopping to offer these things because of fear of liability. They may be stopping to offer these things for other reasons. Our city's recreational programs, alas, are way underfunded. Our country is now so skimpy on how much we provide government for operating these programs. There are other reasons why government cut out programs that are very helpful to the public and are particularly important now they're worried about obesity in children. We need children to have lots of recreational opportunities, but I don't think liability fears are genuinely the core of what's going on.
Catherine Mankiw Ward, how do you see this? You write and think about this a lot at Reason Magazine and at your foundation about sort of the role of parents in these questions and the responsibility of governments.
I think it's tempting to say, you know, a lot of people talk about and sometimes vilify the nanny state. And it's tempting to say, well, in the case of kids, you know, the nanny state is appropriate. I mean, kids do need nannies, right? That's where the term comes from. But perversely, I think decisions like the Supreme Court's decision, and most particularly like the legislation that's being proposed in response to the wave pool incident, take away from parents the right to choose their own level of risk for their kids. When the Supreme Court says you can't, a parental waiver, waiving responsibility for certain risks, isn't valid or isn't valid all the way down, what you're ultimately saying to the parents and to the camp is the final responsibility doesn't rest with the parents. It rests with the camp. It is legally and increasingly culturally held that the camp is responsible for choosing the risk level, and if they choose in a way that results in injury, that they will be liable.
So your concern would be that this sort of allows parents to escape accountability, escape responsibility?
It does, although I think it's actually less a question of allowing them to escape than just not giving them the opportunity to make decisions in the first place. I mean, in this particular case with the girl at camp, her parents had given instructions to the counselors, even if she had seizures, to let her participate. They didn't want her to be restricted.
Hmm.
by her disability. They had said, essentially, we recognize that there's a higher risk in letting her participate in these activities immediately after the seizure, but we want her to do that because she likes to swim, she likes to, you know, ride horseback. When you take the ability for parents to say that away from them, they also you also lose, you know, a really important part of raising kids.
Well, let's dig into this question of the waiver then and what it's worth and help us understand these, Steve Sugarman at Bolt Hall School of Law, because the parents did sign a waiver. The courts have said, well, even if you sign a waiver, if there's gross negligence, you can still sue. But how much then is a waiver worth? I think it seems to me that what people are concerned about, both recreational programs and private health clubs, are that if waivers aren't worth much, then how are we ever protected? Help us understand that part of this argument.
Well, I think that the California Supreme Court says is that we don't want providers of recreational activity to be able to engage in gross negligence and then walk away from the harms that they cause.
And just say, see, they signed a waiver,
yeah,
we're not responsible?
You know,
yeah.
I mean, in other words, I think I should also emphasize is that, and as Steve Wally would, I think, agree, it's not at all clear that the parents will win this case.
Right.
I mean, this is,
right.
It's legal technicalities we haven't yet talked about, but they probably will have to prove gross negligence. They may well not be able to do it. The counselor apparently looked away just for a moment. I mean, the counselor had been very attentive to the child earlier on, and things that have been said about the case, I think, are already accurate. So it's not at all clear that the parents will win. The question simply here was a preliminary question. Should Santa Barbara completely get off from responsibility because of the waiver?
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, what the courts have said. And it's not uncommon for courts here in California and other states to say that these kinds of certain kinds of liability waivers are just unacceptable. I'll give you a different example. The University of California at San Francisco, my university, once had a policy that if you came in to the facility in San Francisco, it was probably the county hospital, and to be served by UC San Francisco doctors, and you were a charity patient, you had to agree that you wouldn't sue for malpractice if you would be injured. And, you know, in a way, the university says, well, we don't have to help these people, and we're helping them for free, but we don't want to be sued. And the California Supreme Court said, nothing doing. This someone wanders into an emergency room. They need immediate care, whatever it is. They're not in a position to say no, to reject the offer. They need attention. You make them sign this waiver. That's not any good. We don't want providers of essential public services to be able to, like the hospital services, to be able to waive their responsibility to exercise care when they provide medical services. And so that's a strong example, but I think it's a good example of where the court says not all waivers are going to be valid. It used to be the automobile companies would say, we will fix your transmission or your engine for the first three months, but you can't sue us. If the car blows up, even though the car was defective. These are waivers that are no longer valid.
We'll have to hold you there, if I might, Professor Sugarman, because we have to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll dig into this question more about what a waiver accounts for and what some of the implications of this are for future recreational programs. We welcome your conversation and participation in our program, too. What do you think the rights and responsibilities are of parents and of government and private recreational programs? You can join us now by calling 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, liability and responsibility, the question of who's responsible when a tragic incident takes place. Does signing a waiver foreclose the possibility of a parent claiming damages later? What are the responsibilities and differences between what a parent should take charge of and what a city program or a private recreational program should offer? We're having this discussion, of course, in light of two recent tragedies, one having to do with a child who drowned at Great America Amusement Park a week ago Thursday, and the other the story of a developmentally disabled child who drowned 5 years ago at a program sponsored by the city of Santa Barbara, whose parents now want to sue even though they signed a waiver. Our guests include Steve Sugarman. He's professor of law at the Bolt Hall School of Law, Steve Wiley, city attorney for the city of Santa Barbara, and Catherine Mangue Ward, associate editor of Reason magazine. We welcome your participation in our conversation as well. You can join us now at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org, forum@kqed.org. We were talking before the break, Professor Sugarman was describing that a waiver is not always allowable, and he described a situation at a hospital where you couldn't waive away your rights to sue for malpractice just because you had signed something accordingly before your care took place. And I want to ask about the sort of risk that people should take on themselves. And Professor Sugarman, for example, another example that's often given, a friend of mine who's an attorney was citing to me earlier this morning the example of when you go to a ball game, there's on the back of your baseball ticket, there's a little warning saying the ballpark's not responsible if you get hit by a foul ball. The point being that any time you participate in a recreational event, you have to assume certain responsibility. What if anything, do these cases point to in that regard?
Well, I think the point about the baseball game should be made a little clearer. Baseball games are not responsible when people are hit by foul balls because of what may be or may not be printed on the ticket. The reason they're not responsible is because they didn't do anything wrong. Mm-hmm. It is not negligent to run baseball games as they now run them. I mean, they could take precautions by fencing in the entire fan base by making everybody sit behind a screen, but we don't want them to do that. People don't want to go to the ball game and have every seat be blocked off by a screen, and people want to be able to scramble to get the foul balls. And so what we do is require them to protect against unreasonable dangers. So right behind home plate, we could really get hurt badly. We want them to put up screens, and they do, and elsewhere we don't want them to, and they don't. And so since they weren't negligent, they acted responsibly. They shouldn't be liable for people who occasionally get hit and sometimes indeed get hurt somewhat from foul balls. And that's, I think, what that's right. And if you're really hyper fearful of being hit, you know, there are plenty of places you can sit where there's no chance that a foul ball would reach you. So I think that's not really quite the point here. We're talking about we shouldn't mix up cases where the recreational activity was a risk, but not an unreasonable risk, just a risk. That's okay. What's not right is, or at least when you possibly have a lawsuit, is when the risk is unreasonably dangerous.
And Steve Wiley, would your point, though, be that there has to be a certain assumption of risk on the parents' part if they're going to have their child participate in a program like the ones that you have sponsored in the past?
Well, yes. It gets back to what the city knows versus what the parent knows. And again, I'm referring to developmentally disabled children in particular about their abilities and their medical condition. And it was particularly relevant here in terms of what we did not know about this child's condition. And Professor Sugarman was essentially referring to the Tunkel decision from 1963, the emergency room and operation. And, you know, I was just thinking of the 10 judges that, appellate judges that have weighed in on the Janeway case.
That's the Santa Barbara case. Yeah.
Yes. That's 3 judges at the Court of Appeal and 7 at the California Supreme Court. 8 out of 10 agreed that this was not the same as Tunkel, that Santa Barbara's situation was not signing up for a recreational program is not the same as emergency medical services or some of the other decisions relating to Tunkel. And I think that was the right decision, but the Supreme Court decided that they just want to somehow deter grossly negligent conduct, and they weren't going to enforce releases under those circumstances for its deterrent effect. But getting back to, you know, in our case, we had a form, a detailed form, asking the parents, what can your child do? Should your child be restricted from not swimming in the pool as part of this program? Or if your child is in the pool, should we put a flotation device on the child? Do you want to accompany the child? Do you want to send someone to accompany? And we had parents doing this. We had kids in there with flotation devices. We had kids with their mothers with them. And in this case, we even assigned a one-on-one aide. We weren't required to do that. We weren't asked to do that. But we had prior experience with Katie Janeway and the frequency of her seizures. So.
And Catherine Mangu-Bord, that takes us back to your point, which is essentially that you know, parents have to have, in the end, some responsibility for this. And as Steve Wiley describes, it sounds like the city of Santa Barbara put forward a lot of effort to make sure that they were providing the right kind of safety circumstances.
That's right. And I think it was also true to a pretty large extent to what we can see so far in the Great America case. When we look at the provisions that Ms. Alquist was suggesting for the bill that she's pushing, Great America already met a lot of those provisions. They did have life vests available, although they weren't required, and they had signs posted saying, please watch your children at all times. There was a bell that rang to alert swimmers when the waves were about to begin, and they didn't have, I think, minimum restrictions for height, but it's not clear, depending on where the line is drawn, that Carlos would have, the child who died, would have been below those restrictions in the first place. So it's not just parents. There's also a lot of intermediary institutions between parents and the state. There's, you know, Great America itself, right after the incident, changed its policies. And a lot of other wave parks already have more stringent policies. Same thing is true with camps. In this particular case, the camp was run by the city, but private camps, the same thing is true. I mean, I know when I went to camp as a child, I hated being strapped into water wings at the pool, but I was very young, and that was the policy, and that's what they did. So it's not just either parents are responsible or we have to have specific legislation about rules at wave pools. There is a lot of middle ground.
And let's get our callers engaged in our conversation as well. Christine in Menlo Park wants to be part of our program. Christine, go ahead. You're on.
Thank you very much. My comment is a comment about both cases. In Great America, as a parent, I feel so sorry for the loss of the child, for the parents, but I cannot imagine ever leaving a small child unattended in a pool as a parent. And that's I just can't imagine that. And as for myself, as a mother of a developmentally delayed son, I believe in inclusion. My son has always been included in school and in programs, and I'm a strong supporter of inclusion. However, when it comes to sports, there is a responsibility of programs to monitor appropriately each individual task that the children are participating in. And when it comes to water, whether a child is developmentally delayed or not, you can never turn your back for a second in the water on somebody who is not water safe. And especially the very nature of a program for the developmentally delayed, you have a responsibility, and even a waiver does not take away the responsibility that that person's life is in your hands.
And
if you turn around, you have the responsibility for that person's life.
And Christine,
you
sorry
turn
to
turn around and yeah. You leave that person alone for a second.
Christine, I just want to ask you, if I might, when you say you have a responsibility, because this gets to the heart of our discussion, it's the you that you refer to, the
exactly.
parent or the program?
Whose life is it? Who has the care and the responsibility of that person's life in the water at that moment? The program does.
Okay.
The program does. And the waiver that the parent signed does not take that away.
Yeah. Christine, thank you. I'm just going to have to hold you there. I appreciate your point and how close this cuts to home, but I need to get some other callers involved in our discussion as well. Thanks so much for joining us and for giving us your point of view. Heather in Carmichael wants to chime in on this same point. Heather, you're on.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am the mother of an 8-year-old boy with epilepsy, and I think it is ultimately a parent's responsibility at all times. Every time I've enrolled my son in any sort of program, I am always there. I always attend. I'm always within 10 feet of him just to make sure that in the off chance he does have a seizure, that I am prepared to do whatever I can for my son. I don't hold anyone else responsible for that duty except for myself.
Heather, thanks. Thanks for calling and making that point. Responses to that all around. Once, Catherine Mangu-Ward first.
I think that the two conflicting, or I guess the two views in tension that we've just heard from the two mothers really demonstrates the crux of the thing. I mean, there's always going to be, I know Professor Sugarman said that people who are unwilling to trust the courts to make the distinction between gross negligence maybe are not being very fair, that judges and juries do, by and large, do a good job with these cases, but you know, when you talk to someone like our first caller, who's just very passionate, who feels very strongly that any bad outcome is by definition gross negligence, it's hard to trust that juries and that judges will draw lines that are rational and appropriate. It's completely reasonable that she should have this very strong emotional response, but it does make people who are concerned about drawing lines in this blurry concept of gross negligence, you know, they have a point. There's always going to be people who just think any time a kid is hurt, there must have been negligence.
But Steve Sugarman, your point would be that's what the court should do, right, is sort out those sorts of questions and cut through the best they can to the understandable passions and emotions that surround these sorts of moments and figure it out. That's what they're supposed to do.
That is what they're supposed to do. Now, I should say that we haven't talked about ordinary negligence in recreational settings. And Steve Wiley's right that providing recreational activities may not be viewed as the same as providing critical medical care. And the California Supreme Court in this recent Santa Barbara case left open the question as to whether the waiver would be valid as to ordinary negligence, just ordinary carelessness, not gross negligence. They left open that question, but the hints are, and we have several lower courts decisions by other than our Supreme Court, but the next appellate level, lower down appellate level court, which says that you can waive, at least in many settings, ordinary negligence, so that because of this very concern that's been raised, that well, what exactly how is it? Wasn't really negligence, or was it not? And that's why I think health clubs, I think, are a good example of this. People can get injured at the health club. Was it that they used the equipment improperly? Was it they were not in shape? Was it an injury they had elsewhere that they're now saying was at the health club? Or was it really something about bad instruction or bad maintenance of the equipment? That can often be a very contested and a very difficult problem. And health clubs understandably fear that when someone comes around with an injury, they're going to be blamed. And they say, look, let's make a deal. Or just ordinary negligence, how about you agree not to sue us. Let's, you know, you have your own health insurance, hopefully, but of course not everyone has that. Maybe we'll have the fees a little bit lower, although maybe not. And that's the kind of talk that you get from the recreational providers. And the courts, as I say, in California, not our Supreme Court yet, but other courts have said, you know, maybe there's something to that, these close call, ordinary negligence cases. I should say, by contrast, though, in Vermont, for example, ski resorts tried to waive liability for ordinary negligence, and that's business for Vermont. It's a big, important industry for them. And the Vermont Supreme Court said, come on, we want our ski resorts to run reasonably careful, not unreasonably dangerous ski operations. We're not going to allow those waivers. In New York, the same. So this too is an issue as to how much we should, you know, for fear of mistaken jury decision, should we allow careless parties to get away
right.
with it.
It's a fair point, Steve Wiley, isn't it, that in these sorts of activities that involve some element of risk, whether it's skiing or horseback riding, it's not unfair to assume or to want that those programs be run in a safe way and that no matter what kind of waiver you sign, as a parent or as a child, there should be a certain fair assumption that you're not going to be endangered in some sort of reckless way.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I'm a parent, like a lot of people, and I feel that way. I think we can all agree with the first caller in that sense. But, you know, I think lawyers and judges at times sort of lose sight of what really motivates people. And the California Supreme Court said, we're going to deter grossly negligent conduct here. And we made this point to the court, the average 19-year-old, and the age of the counselor in our case, or 20-year-old, and we're talking about people who are in this case dedicated to helping developmentally disabled children. They want to have a career in that. They don't know anything about the Janeway case. They don't typically. I've worked with people like this for years. They don't know that there's even a waiver out there. They're in it because they're dedicated individuals, and the last thing they want to see happen is someone get hurt or be responsible for someone getting hurt. They're motivated by that natural instinct, by being protective, by their attraction to being caregivers, not by the Janeway decision or the legal system, in my opinion. And it's really a question of can you preclude the litigation altogether with these waivers, not winning in front of the jury, not even winning in front of the judge at the trial by having the judge say that the evidence is insufficient to establish gross negligence. You know, the average insurance company is not going to take these cases to trial. They typically would have to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars just to prevail at trial. And so these cases will be settled, and that's where the increases in insurance rates will happen, if they happen. If I could add one thing about comparing California to other states, and we briefed this at the request of the California Supreme Court, it's just not accurate, in my opinion, to take a state like Vermont or New York or Colorado or Utah and compare them to California. For example, in New York, there is a statute that grants immunity to public recreation providers for ordinary negligence. They don't need a waiver in New York. They've got an immunity statute. In Colorado, there is a cap, and this is a very common statute across the 50 states, a cap on liability damages for public entities of $150,000. Well, if we had a cap like that in California, we wouldn't even be having this conversation.
And let's get more of our callers involved in our conversation. Liz joins us next in San Francisco. Liz, you're on.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I hate to go on and on about the waivers, but I find this so interesting because every time I sign my children up for anything, and any time I sign myself up for anything, I sign a waiver. And I never read it. I mean, I'm not a lawyer. I'm so used to doing this, I sort of assume it's meaningless. And I'm worried now that it's not. And I'm wondering, as a parent or as an individual, what sort of rights do I have if I don't want to sign the waiver? Can I force the organization to take me or my children anyway?
Liz, thanks for the call and the question. Steve Wiley, you want to respond?
No, none of this decision requires a city or a recreation provider to take someone who won't sign a waiver. In our case, we allowed you to bonify the activity, the camp activity that the child would participate in. And I think that was a key point for the California Supreme Court in not saying that this was a Tunkel situation. That in essence, our waiver was negotiable, not the language. The lawyers would never allow that of the actual waiver, but the activity to which the waiver applied was very negotiable.
So that the parents could be specific about what they wanted their child to do and not do and how they wanted that participation to take place?
Yes.
And to Eric next, who joins us in Berkeley. Eric, you're on.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I've been a guide for a number of years now in the Bay Area, both nonprofit and for-profit. In fact, I'm going out this afternoon to teach kayaking. I know that just these public decisions play a big role in what classes will run. I mean, you know, if it's a nonprofit, will we put an inner-city kid in a in a life jacket in a canoe. If we don't know if he can swim, you know, maybe we won't. With these kind of court cases can cut these programs off. I remember there was a case with snowboarders in Colorado that a woman sued the ski resort, won, and it sent shockwaves through the entire outdoor industry. And, you know, there are probably some programs we didn't run as a result of that, and people we didn't reach out to.
So you'd concur with the point that Steve Wiley, the city attorney from Santa Barbara, was making earlier, that these sorts of situations will peel back the number of recreational opportunities that are available, particularly to kids who may be at risk in some sort of form?
Oh, absolutely. They're not making any money with these kind of things. Even for-profit companies aren't making much money. And a lawsuit that you win, even if you win, it's very expensive. And it's just easiest not to run the program at all.
Yeah.
And there are people who just, don't want to take that kind of risk, especially if it's nonprofit. And I'd hate to see a freak accident ruin it for everybody.
Eric, thanks. Thanks for the call. Steve Sugarman, your response, because you raised earlier the question that you weren't so sure these sorts of decisions would necessarily push those recreational opportunities away.
Well, I want to emphasize that it may well be that our courts, and indeed many of our lower courts, have already upheld waivers, releases of liability for ordinary negligence in the recreational setting as opposed into the hospital setting or low-income housing setting or so on. And it seems to me that if they were to uphold those, that ought to give these providers more than enough protection against fears of the liability fears that they say they have. I also think that it's easy to, of course, people don't like to be sued, and people don't like to be held liable or even have to have their insurance company settle in a case in which they think nothing was wrong. You know, if we had a system in which we had a very comprehensive health insurance coverage for everybody and much better income protection for accidental loss of income than we have in our country, one might think very differently about these matters. In New Zealand, for example, you cannot sue at all for these kinds of injuries, but they have a comprehensive accident compensation system, so anyone's hurt in a recreational activity there gets their medical bills paid, gets their income replaced. We don't have this here, so many people turn to the legal system because there's no other source of compensation for their basic needs.
Let me get in a couple of emails that have come in. Ted writes, I was formerly the CFO of a large nonprofit organization in California. We had programs that offered services to youth and the aged. Those programs involved water sports in particular, and they were extremely hard to insure and extremely expensive. It is a virtual certainty that some worthy programs will lose their coverage as a result of these kinds of decisions. And back to more of our callers. Jim, lifeguard, wants to join our conversation. Jim, you're on.
Hi, how are you guys doing today?
Good, thank you.
Good. I work for the city of Oakland. Actually, I'm the aquatics director, and I have an aquatic safety consulting company. And I think the point of pushing opportunities away is really valid. Unless you offer 7 public pools for the citizens of a community, that will never close. You know, aquatics is always going to be high risk, and there's always going to be accountability on both parts of the parties, the parents that bring small children to those pools and the people that protect them. I think in the case of Great America, the nature of lifeguarding a crowded pool like that, you know, you turn your head away to look at one set of patrons and turn back, and if someone gets knocked over in that time between the bodies and surface disturbance and splashing and noise, it's kind of a no-win. So I'm really in favor of parents staying with those small kids, and I think life jackets should definitely be optional.
Jim, thanks.
Not required.
Jim, thanks. Thanks for the call and the observation. Pam is next in San Jose. Pam, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I travel on business to Europe and actually to Japan as well, and their system is so much more one of personal responsibility. At what point are Americans trying to just make somebody take their pain away and pay them for something? And also, how much of this is because we don't have universal medical coverage?
Yeah. Pam, thank you. It's an observation that I think combines both the point that Steve Sugarman made a moment ago and also some of what you've been saying, Catherine Mangue Ward. Chime in on that.
I think we have a general cultural sense that, there's a certain amount of risks that kids should take, and there's a certain amount of risk that parents are choosing for their kids. There's this book right now that's very popular, The Dangerous Book for Boys, which promotes a return to sort of a mildly hazardous, unsupervised childhood. But it's because we recognize there's something to that. There's something important about getting an inner-city kid into a canoe. There's something important about getting a developmentally disabled kid into the pool with the other kids. And even if we have real legitimate fears about gross negligence, and even if we have real legitimate fears about, you know, terrible accidents, there's still a huge value to letting parents choose a non-zero level of risk for their kids. And the further we go down both state legislation and, in some cases, litigation lines, the farther away we get from that.
Just have about a minute left, so just a last quick thought. Steve Sugarman first. We began the program with a pediatrician saying best advice is to keep your eyes wide open. Your brief, I guess, legal parental advice would also be to keep your eyes wide open?
Well, if you don't like the waivers, you can try crossing them out, and often they don't do anything. They don't notice it, and they don't pay any attention, and then you're, you don't have to worry about this.
And Steve Wiley, a last thought from you about what you think people should be thinking about, I guess, the rest of this summer in terms of the amount of risk they're willing to take on and what their hopes are for recreational programs like you offer.
Well, I guess I'd only ask that people think about communicating to a recreational provider what it is that their kids are actually capable of and should be trying and should be exposed to. And I hope that communication, because I think every city that I know of, every rec provider that I know of would be open saying, yes, we do require release for this camp program, but we certainly want to know what restrictions you would like placed on your child, and we'll observe those.
Steve Wiley, city attorney for the city of Santa Barbara, joined us this hour. Mr. Wiley, thank you. Thanks for being part of our discussion.
You're very welcome.
Steve Sugarman was here as well. He is the Agnes Roddy Robb Professor of Law at the Bolt Hall School of Law at the University of California, Berkeley. Steve Sugarman, thanks for being part of our program.
My pleasure.
And also to Catherine Mangu Ward, who is the associate editor of Reason Magazine. Catherine Mangu Ward, thanks for your participation as well.
Thank you.
Forum is produced by Robin Giannatasio-Mall and Kevin Guillory, with additional producing assistance from Cecilia Koth on this particular program. We thank them for that. Our engineer this past hour is Dave Freeman, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Coming up in our second hour, we're going to focus on an exhibit about the art that's been inspired by Yosemite. That's coming up in our second hour. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.